245. The good old days are gone. In Mozart, they sang themselves out. How lucky we are that his Rococo still speaks to us, that his good society, his loving raptures, his childish delight in Chinese effects and curlicues, the civility in his heart, his desire for delicacy, lovers, dancers, those with blissful tears, his faith in the South, can still appeal to some remnant in us. Alas, at some point, it will be gone. But who can doubt that the understanding of and taste for Beethoven will be gone even earlier? He was, in fact, only the final chords of a stylistic transition, a break in style, and not, like Mozart, the final notes of a great centuries-long European taste. Beethoven is something that happens between an old, crumbling soul which is constantly breaking up and a very young soul of the future which is constantly advancing. In his music there lies that half-light of eternal loss and of eternally indulgent hoping, that same light in which Europe was bathed when it dreamed with Rousseau, when it danced around the freedom tree of revolution, and finally almost worshipped before Napoleon. But how quickly now this very feeling fades. Nowadays how difficult it has already become to know this feeling. How foreign to our ears sounds the talk of Rousseau, Schiller, Shelley, and Byron, in whom collectively the same European fate found a way in words which it knew how to sing in Beethoven. What has come in German music since then belongs to the Romantic period, that is, historically considered, to an even shorter, even more fleeting, even more superficial movement than was that great interlude, that transition in Europe from Rousseau to Napoleon and to the arrival of democracy. Weber. But what are Freischutz and Oberon for us these days? Or Marschner's Hans Heiling and Vampir? Or even Wagner's Tannhäuser? That music has faded, even if it has not yet been forgotten. In addition, all this romantic music was not sufficiently noble, not sufficiently musical, to justify itself anywhere other than in the theatre and in front of crowds. Right from the start, it was second-rate music, of little interest among true musicians. The situation was different with Felix Mendelssohn, that halcyon master, who won rapid admiration for his lighter, purer, and happier soul, and then was forgotten just as quickly as the lovely intermission in German music. But in the case of Robert Schumann, who took his work seriously and from the beginning was also taken seriously, he was the last one who founded a school. Nowadays, don't we count it as good luck, as a relief, and as a liberation that this very Schumann-style romanticism has been overthrown? Schumann ran off into the Saxon Switzerland of his soul, half like Werther, half like Jean-Paul, but certainly nothing like Beethoven, certainly nothing like Byron. The music of his Manfred is an error in judgment and a misunderstanding to the point of injustice. Schumann, with his taste, which was basically a petty taste, that is, a dangerous tendency, doubly dangerous among the Germans, toward quiet lyricism and a drunken intoxication of feeling, always going off to the side, shyly withdrawing himself and pulling back, a noble delicacy which wallowed in nothing but anonymous happiness and sorrow, from the start a sort of young maiden and noli me tangere, do not touch me. This Schumann was already merely a German event in music, no longer something European as Beethoven was, and to an even greater extent Mozart. With him, German music was threatened by its greatest danger, the loss of its voice for the soul of Europe, and its descent to something dealing merely with the fatherland. 246. What a torture are books written in German for the man who has a third ear. How reluctantly he stands beside the slowly revolving swamp of sounds without melody, of rhythms without dance. What among Germans is called a book. And as for the German who reads books, how lazily, how reluctantly, how badly he reads. How many Germans know and demand from themselves the knowledge that there is art in every good sentence? Art which must be acknowledged if the sentence is to be understood. With a misunderstanding about its tempo, for example, the sentence itself is misunderstood. That one must not be in doubt about the rhythmically decisive syllables, that one must feel the break in the extremely strict symmetry as intentional and charming, that one must lend a refined and patient ear to every staccato and every rubato, that one sorts out the sense in the series of vowels and diphthongs, how softly and richly they can colour and recolour each other as they follow in sequence. Who among our book-reading Germans has enough goodwill to recognise these sorts of duties and demands, and to listen for so much art and intentionality in language? In the end, we just don't have the ear for that. And thus the most pronounced contrasts in style are not heard, and the most refined artistry is wasted, as if on deaf people. These were my thoughts, as I observed how crudely and naively people confused two masters of the art of prose with each other, one whose words drip down, hesitant and cold, as if from the roof of a damp cavern, he's relying on their dull sound and echo, and the other who handles his language like a flexible sword, and feels from his arm down to his toes the dangerous joy in the excessively sharp, shimmering blade that wants to bite, hiss, and cut.